Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we explore an idea on the Parsha through the lens of books and articles on Jewish history that I try to read each and every Shabbos. Thank you so much to our sponsors, my dearest friends Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. And of course, a reminder to sign up for our Substack, where you can get all the links, books, articles that are mentioned therein. You can find that at readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. After Yosef is sold into slavery by his brothers, he winds up in the house of Potiphar. Every day, Potiphar's wife incessantly tries to seduce Yosef. Finally, one day, they are alone in the house. Yosef literally has to run away from Potiphar's house in order to ultimately avoid her. What prevented Yosef from succumbing to her advances? Rashi, on the spot, famously cites the moving imagery from the Talmud, the Gemara in Sota, on Daf, Lamed, Vav, Amud Beis. The Gemara says as follows, and of course I will translate. It quotes from the Pasuk that we have in our Parsha, Vatispeshehu Bevigdo Lemor, and she caught Yosef by his garment, saying, and the Gemara says, Be'osa Shah, at that moment, Basa Diukno Shel Aviv Vinerasa Lo Bachalon. That moment, his father's image came and appeared to him in the window. What did that image say? Amar Lo. This image of his father Yaakov said to him, Yosef, my son, Asidin Achecha Sheyichtavu Al Avnei Ephod. In the future, you and your brothers are going to be written on the stones of the ephod worn by the Kohen Gadol. Va'ata Beinehem, and you are among them. Ritzoncha Sheyimcha Shimcha Mi Beinehem. Do you want your name to be erased from one of the stones of the ephod? Vitikra Roa Zonos, and instead they're going to call you somebody who is an associate of a promiscuous, licentious women. Tichsiv Veroa Zomed Ya'abed Hon, the pasuk in Mishlei. Somebody who keeps company with inappropriate people, waste his riches, and you, Yosef, are at risk of losing that future legacy. Yosef sees the image of his father through a window, Demus Diukno Shel Aviv Nirasala Bechalon, and that gave him the strength to avoid Potiphar's wife. Strangely, Tosfos, on the spot in that Gemara on Sota, gets caught up with a seemingly inconsequential detail. What does Tosfos want to know? Tosfos asks, how do we know that his father's image appears specifically through a window? Why is Toso so caught up with the fact that the image appeared through a window? It's just narrative flair. Why is the appearance of Yaakov specifically through a window so significant to this story? To understand this, let's explore the story of some, not all, but some of the life and thought of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik was born in 1903. He died at the age of 90 in 1993. Long identified with the biblical personality of Yosef, the star of our Parsha this week. Beyond their shared name, Yosef, of course, Rabbi Soloveitchik couched his actual move towards the religious Zionism of Mizrahi within the paradigm of Yosef, as he explains in his work Chamesh Drashos, which was later translated as the Five Addresses. Rabbi Soloveitchik, like the biblical Yosef, Yosef departed from his brothers. Rabbi Soloveitchik was raised in an Agudist home. His grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was not a Zionist. Still, having feelings of religious Zionism was not entirely foreign to the family either. His great-great-uncle, I believe I'm getting that family correct, there's a little inside baseball, I believe Reb Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik married the daughter of Reb Rafal Shapiro, who's the son-in-law of the Netziv, and Rav Meir Bar Ilan, who was one of the early founders of Mizrahi, was the youngest son of the Netziv. I believe that makes Rav Meir Bar Ilan Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's great-great uncle. And he was an early leader of Mizrahi, and his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, actually taught in a Mizrahi-affiliated school in Warsaw. It was there in Warsaw that the young Rabbi Soloveitchik had his first experience with communal isolation. As Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet explains in a wonderful article, he's written so much about this, about Rabbi Soloveitchik's gradual move to religious Zionism. This really caught my eye, the description that he has there of Rabbi Soloveitchik as a child, watching and looking at his father teaching the Mizrahi school. This is what Rabbi Rakefet writes. The Rav saw, when he says the Rav, he's referring to Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, a whole bunch of different rabbis who their students call them the Rav. One is Rabbi Soloveitchik's uncle, the Briska Rav, we'll get to him, and in Eretz Yisrael, the students of Rav Kook also call him Harav. So this Rav, we're referring to the students in America of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And he writes as follows. The Rav saw how his father was mocked and rejected by his family due to his association with the Mizrahi institution. Furthermore, the Rav saw his father suffering within the school as his conservative views differed from the more radical and modern approach of certain members of the faculty. The intense sensation of pain a child feels when he sees his father unhappy runs deep, and the Rav's childhood experiences of watching his father suffer firmly established a negative association with Mizrahi organizations. So Rabbi Soloveitchik remained firmly within the Agudist worldview, which was certainly not an overtly Zionist organization. I don't know if I would describe them as anti-Zionist, but certainly not a Zionist organization. And he held off any full embrace of Zionism within his religious life. In 1940, in fact, he was asked by Agudas Yisrael in America to deliver a eulogy for their recently departed leader, Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, who was like the acknowledged leader of the Aguda world. And as his grandson, Rav Meir Twersky, recounts in a beautiful article in Tradition, that he was asked to give a eulogy because of kind of his breadth and creativity. This is what Rabbi Meir Twersky recounts. I love this story. It's so beautiful. In 1940, Agudas Yisrael in America convened a memorial gathering upon the passing of the universally recognized giant and leader of the generation, Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. The Rav, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was invited to deliver the eulogy. In his introduction, Rav Eliezer Silver Zatzal cited the Talmudic passage which recounts Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's last words to the sages prior to his passing. Al tisveduni b'ayaros. Do not eulogize me in small cities. The Talmud explains that he instructed them so to uphold the respect and dignity of Torah. Rabbi Silver, this is so beautiful, interpreted the Rebbe's instructions homiletically. And he writes in Yiddish, I'm a little embarrassed, my Yiddish is terrible, so I'm not going to read it, but it says, Zait mir nish maspit, you know what, I'm not going to read it, I don't want to embarrass myself, and if you're driving or doing something important, I don't want any of the listeners to be distracted with laughter. I'm not going to actually try to read that Yiddish, it's so embarrassing. But what did he mean by that? Why did Rev Eliezer Silver introduce Rabbi Soloveitchik's eulogy this way? He interpreted this Gemara that Rev Yehuda Hanasi says, Al tisveduni be'yaros, do not eulogize me in small cities. What did he mean? Do not eulogize me in a provincial, small-minded way. Rather, eulogize me with breadth, depth, sweep, and scope. To ensure just such a moving monumental memorial tribute to Reb Chaim Ozer Zatzal, concluded Rav Silver, we turn to Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik to deliver the eulogy. In 1926, Rabbi Soloveitchik spent a few years studying in the University of Berlin, where he picked up much of the philosophical language that appears in his later English publications. Throughout his time in Berlin, he corresponded with his father in Torah learning. A lot of these letters were published in his collected letters under the title Igros Hagrid. This was like what anchored him, continued his depth of Torah learning even while at the University of Berlin. Ultimately, his deliberate move into the world of religious Zionism was concretized and articulated in his 1956 address, Kol Dodi Dofek, My Beloved is Knocking, and a few years later, again, in a series of addresses to Hapol HaMizrahi, later published as Chamesh Drashot, The Five Addresses. One of the Chamesh Drashos is called And Joseph Dreamt a Dream. This was given originally in 1962, and there Rabbi Soloveitchik most explicitly couches his decision to leave Aguda and join Mizrahi within, specifically, the personality of Yosef. As Dr. Dina Rabinovich explains in her detailed essay, it's a very accessible, wonderful essay with great footnotes. She wrote an essay called The Five Drashot and the Rav's Engagement with the Zionist Project, where she explains Rabbi Soloveitchik's drasha essentially was that Yosef's fight with his brothers was about how to react to the changing landscape of the world. Yosef advocated that it was time for the family to evolve and embrace the new circumstances and changing economies, while his brothers did not want to abandon the purity and holiness of their lives that they had built in Canaan. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik felt his rabbinic colleagues, even his own family, were making a similar mistake by not embracing religious Zionism. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, now fully inhabiting the role of the biblical Yosef, writes, unconsciously sensed that, these are the words of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that they unconsciously sensed that it was forbidden to rely on a continuation of the status quo, that great changes were about to occur in Jewish life for which we would have to be prepared. He sensed the advent of an era when there would be no yeshivot in Brisk, Vilna, and Minsk, when America would be turned into a place of Torah, and when Israel, the state of Israel, would become the core center of Torah. Rabbi Soloveitchik knew that his break from his brothers, so to speak, would come at a cost, and even then he is frank that he is not yet ready to cast the entirety of his ideological lot with them. As Rabbi Soloveitchik explains, I built an altar upon which I sacrificed sleepless nights, doubts, and reservations. The Mizrahi must understand that Jews like me, who join the movement and who draw their nourishment from the ancient Talmudic soil of Abaya and Rava, are in the category of Joseph, of Yosef, the biblical Yosef. They are required to sacrifice on this altar their peace of mind as well as their social relationships and friends. The Mizrahi must also understand that we do not use the phrase Zionism plus religious or religious Zionism. For us, there is only one unique noun, Torah. Israel is holy and dear because the Torah sanctified it and because the Torah's future is tied to it. This rupture from his familial tradition had enduring costs, most notably Rabbi Soloveitchik's standing within the yeshiva world. Of course, there were other reasons for this distancing between Rabbi Soloveitchik and the yeshiva world. That's a topic for a different time that I'm sure we will one day explore more deeply. But this divergence definitely created a particularly invective wedge between Rabbi Soloveitchik and his brisker cousins in Israel. As many have noted, Rabbi Soloveitchik identified with the biblical character Yosef. That's how we began. Normally, this is associated with Rabbi Soloveitchik's classic approach to religious Zionism couched in the story of Yosef's dreams. But there's actually an earlier work which much more subtly evokes this personality. If you don't read carefully, you might miss it altogether. In 1983, Rabbi Soloveitchik published Halachic Man, which was an English translation of an earlier Hebrew work that was first published in 1944. It's called Isha Halacha. It was originally even published in a little journal. Professor Lawrence Kaplan, he's the one who translated the work, just published a special edition of the 40th anniversary of its publication. The epigraph, that's like the opening page, you have like a little quote over there. The epigraph to Halachic Man reads as follows, and there's no explanation, this is what it says. At that moment, the image of his father came to him and appeared before him in the window. Quoting again, Sota 36b. It's a curious opening to a work that otherwise deals with the inner world view of someone who lives within the halachic system. Why does he invoke this story of Yosef and the wife of Potiphar as the introduction, so to speak, to Halachic Man, which is about this very sober, objective world view when you inhabit all of your life in the Dalet Amos, in the four cubits of halacha? Many, such as Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, understand this line as referring to the temptation represented by the wife of Potiphar of Western philosophy during Rabbi Soloveitchik's time in Berlin, and how the legacy of his father anchored him to the world of Torah. As Rabbi Sacks writes, there can be no doubt as to Rabbi Soloveitchik's meaning. He is reassuring the spirit of his father, who had recently died, that he would not be seduced by the strange woman of Western philosophy. Yet the quotation suggests the doubt and tension he felt. Professor David Schatz takes issue with the connection drawn between Western philosophy and the wife of Potiphar. Instead, he emphasizes that what we can definitively draw from Rabbi Soloveitchik's choice to have this passage as the introduction to his work is the role his father played as the actual halachic man. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this reading, was not halachic man. It was actually Rabbi Soloveitchik's father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who in Rabbi Soloveitchik's life served as the quintessential halachic man. The critical point, explains Professor Schatz, about the passage which Rabbi Soloveitchik cites is the substance of what is occurring in the passage. Ish ha-halacha is a demut diukno shel aviv, is the image of his father, a portrait of the image of his father. As Professor Kaplan concludes his introduction to the new edition of Halachic Man, Rabbi Soloveitchik prefaces Halachic Man with a Talmudic statement: at that moment, the image of his father came to him and appeared before him in the window. Indeed, Soloveitchik once remarked to me that he wrote Halachic Man with the images of his father, who died in 1941, 3 years before the essay's publication, and grandfather constantly before his inner eye. And yet, I dare say that the luster of Halachic Man, Soloveitchik's first great essay, his first major philosophical statement, a luster that has not diminished since it was first appeared in Hebrew in 1944 and in English translation in 1983, ultimately derives from the fact that in the essay we see reflected not only the faces of his father and grandfather, but the face, the image, the personality, and the creative spirit of Rabbi Soloveitchik himself. When the chaos of life emerged, when everything becomes uncertain, both Yosef and Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik found solace through the image in the window. Which brings us back to our question. Temptations shrink our world. When the outside world beckons, all you can see sometimes is the moment, the temptation, that opportunity, that dangerous opportunity in front of you. This is why Rabbi Moshe Einstatter explains in his beautiful work, Yesodos on the Parsha, if you've never read it, it's absolutely wonderful. I've read this many, many years ago, but it's always stuck with me. That is why Rabbi Moshe Einstatter explains the window is so crucial to Yosef's story. The temptations of Potiphar's wife shrunk his world. All Yosef could see was the woman in front of him. A window, however, opens up the most important possibility, the future. As Rabbi Einstatter writes, a room is a closed and limited environment. The four walls that surround me are the extent of my present world. This is what I see, and this is where I live. The larger world without does not exist for me. It does not determine my thoughts or my actions. But a window is an aperture that opens up the limited enclosure. Through it, I may perceive an enormous breadth and an unlimited horizon. This great world now becomes my world. I live in it and not in the confines of my little room. This magnificent vision liberates me from the confinement of my own smallness. I breathe in the pure air and I feel the blood coursing through my veins. I peer into the distance and it seems to me that I can see further than I have ever seen before. And there I behold a vision of unequaled splendor. And here Rabbi Einstatter returns and weaves in his idea into the passage in the Gemara that we read earlier. And there I behold a vision of unequaled splendor, my Evan HaEphod, the stone on the breastplate that Yaakov Avinu in this story warned, reminded Yosef of, don't lose your place in that stone on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. It is more real to me than my present surroundings, and it takes entire possession of me. What would I not give in order to possess it? I feel that the meaning of my life is inextricably bound up with the object of this vision. I vow not to rest until I have gained possession of it. Yosef needed a window. It was only through a window that he could see beyond the confines of Potiphar's home and be reminded of the legacy, the demus diukno, of his father Yaakov. It was through the window that Yosef could see into his own future. So thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. Thank you again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hoda and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Another reminder to sign up for our Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com, where you can get all the articles and books that we reference in the Shir each and every week. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading every single Shabbos.